So our three presenters are Azad Mesrourian from Syria, Carolyn Ilitalo, also born in Syria, and Francis Lilian, who was born in Iran. And the moderator will be Tom Kelchik, who's passing little cards around. Tom is an ACOM past president. He's been very involved with the community and has come up with very many bright ideas of events that we've done here for ACOM.
Well, thank you, Dr. Last year, we did a review of the root causes of the genocide. So we thought we'd follow up with the diaspora. What happened to these people? Where did they go? What happened to them? And the first activity we've already participated in, that was take this little pink dot and locate on the map where you believe your family was from, or you knew that your family was from. And I think if you look at it, I think we got a pretty interesting cluster of pinkishness in the map. We had some peripheral people, Constantinople. I don't know who that is. That was my grandmother. That was his grandmother as well, and his great grandmother. And then we have some people from Persia. Who are the Persians here? Okay, interesting. And do you believe that they have been at some point, perhaps here, and then migrated into Persia? Now, I don't know what the real original source was. And then we have quite a concentration, as you can see here. What this map represents, or at least I tried to represent here, are the deportation routes of the Armenians and some Syrians out from their homes. And the orange lines, the orange directions, are the escape routes that many took. As you can see, one of those escape routes would be to Armenia, to the north, and then, of course, utilizing the Mediterranean Sea through Iskenderun or Alexandretta in Syria, where some of the Europeans offered some relief. So this is that. I thought we needed to have some sort of map presentation so we had orientation. Now, we're not going to get a multimedia presentation. That's it. And it's going to be just basically your participation, these people's participation, and we got some cards out there, and we're going to ask some questions as well. I think you did a nice job of locating those pink dots. Everybody has a sense of where people are from. We might find out that some of us are related. We probably all are. I'd like to ask two basic questions. You don't have to answer. Think about them. How'd you get here? Okay. Pretty profound. How'd you get here? And why am I here? Okay. Think about it. Well, today we're graced with the participation of very erudite, responsible people here. And we're going to be asking them a bunch of questions. They have been given those questions. Some of them, I heard from one source already that he's craftily worked around the questions so he doesn't have to answer them. You can probably guess who that might be. Carolyn Yolato, guys, what's your name? Would you like to say it in person?
Laconian,
all right. A lot easier. And we have this gentleman over here.
Francis Bouguier.
And a second gentleman. So we have questions, and I will begin answering by asking the questions. We're going to ask them in pods. So there'll be four questions. We'll start with Carolyn. We'll go through those four questions, and we'll go to the gentleman here on the right. What is or was your family name in the Ottoman Empire? Okay. And can you tell us what that means?
It just means House of Melkon. Melkon was the name of my
great-great-great-grandfather. Were family members rural or city dwellers in their original habitat?
City dwellers, mostly well-to-do people.
And what is the geographic location of your family's origin?
My father's father came from Urfa, my father's mother from Khalid, my mother's side came from Iskenderun, where I was born.
And you've already said that you were considered to be well off.
Yes.
Upper class?
Yes, I would say so. Like, my father's family owned a lot of land, owned entire villages that Arab farmers worked on. And on the other side were goldsmen, and they had a lot of owned property, homes and shops, and a lot of gold. They traded in gold.
Merchants, landowners, all right, well, now that those are the four questions, so we'll go to Francis. Francis, so what is or was your family name in the Ottoman Empire?
Minasyan. The story is there's some things that happened with ancestry research and DNA. They were Minasyan's great great grandfather. He had two sons. One sang beautifully, the other one looked beautiful. So the one that sang beautiful, they called him Bulbul, Bulbulian. Bulbul means nightingale. Actually, in the American dictionary, Bulbul means songbird or nightingale. Indian, Persian, it really comes from the Persians, the Bulbul, nightingale. And the Turks used it, and Bulgarians, and Arabs. I found out, so my father said we were Minasyans. I thought he was kind of joking. But anyway, we become Bulbulians. And I found out that I have a cousin, a recent cousin, Vahe Güzelinian. I said, Vahe, what's going on? He said, the story is, whenever, you know, if you were a butcher or a carpenter, they called you, carpenter was in that jar. I don't know what the butcher is. So it was pretty difficult. So that's the background there.
And were the family members rural city dwellers? In the
My father was a city dweller in Minka, and he was my father's grandfather and his father were old ministers. They were all educated in the U.S., Princeton, and the town of Princeton, with the help of the missionaries that missionary. So they were city dwellers. My mother lived in Erzurum, the area around Erzurum, and they were landowners. So they're basically called city dwellers. Erzurum is a pretty big city, actually.
So the question, I think you've answered it, you were well off, probably better than middle class.
Well, the minister side were not well off. The community supported them, but on my mother's side, my mom didn't. Go ahead.
Well, let's give this to Hassan. Yeah. And we'll go to the top question. What is and was your family name in the Ottoman Empire?
My father's name was Miss Ruby, and we traced back to the 4th century. St. Mesrum was, of course, the monk that came up with the alphabet. So I don't know how they got the name Mesrum. My mother's name was Inelian, and my father was born in Sivas, where Jordan Park. And they, the story goes that my grandfather was married and decided to go find a job. And 10 years afterward, they didn't hear from him. And my grandmother's brothers went down to find him, and they found him in Ethiopia. So we have some Mesrobians in Ethiopia also, but not the same. Brown color. So I don't know what my grandfather was doing there. They brought him back home. And he had three boys and one girl. The little girl died very young. And they had moved to Samsun. Samsun is a port city
in, on the Black Sea. So he walked all the way from Samsun to Dezor with his two brothers. And we think his age was 10, and the youngest brother was 5. And the mother, Lucy, was brought to, brought into Aleppo to a refugee camp. I don't know, maybe you know where now, but maybe it's not there anymore. It's called the, in Aleppo. But it's Turkish camp. But it was very close to the old city. That's where I was born, a refugee camp.
Well, let's stop there because you're giving way too much information. basically, you're saying your family location is you would identify as Samsun?
Samsun and Antep.
And that was
where my mother's parents came from. And they were spared because my grandmother was a professor at the American University. And so they were saved from deportations.
What would you say they were involved?
They were very, very poor because my grandfather was illiterate. My grandmother was very well off. Their family was very poor. So we came from a very, very poor family.
Okay, well, let's get back now to Carol. What events triggered the exodus of your family? Do you know about the specifics of what happened?
From Arpet, where my father's mother was, the Turkish soldiers came on the road and collected all the men, including her father, and took them to a valley outside the city and killed them. Then they told the women and children, "Time to pack up the next morning." And after they moved them out, they marched them for 650 kilometers, which is about 400 miles, to the Syrian desert over a very long plain. And they just torched and burned the whole place. And I remember I went there in 2015, and I saw the valley where they took all the men and where the old men were settled. And the only thing that was left was the great walls of the church, that mini church, and a few houses of rich people that actually had the walls that were burned, the rest of them burned. And right across the street was a new church. So that was my idea. That's what happened. I think that's what was well documented. That happened. And the location where they killed the men was also like my father's side, rumors spread because Urfa was towards the south and a lot of the southern province were part of Urfa and Hanukkah and Maraj. It happened later. So there were rumors that they're killing all the men. And because their family was so wealthy, he escaped and they owned so much land. So he went to one of the landowners or the people who managed one of the villages the family and he hit them. But what we didn't know, the assumption was that it was going to happen, so they were told to run away. But he only stayed thinking, oh, they're not going to do anything to the men and children, his mother, his wife, his kids, they're not going to do anything for them. I'll just disappear and they'll be okay. But
do you know the name of the site where the men were killed?
It's there. You go to Parvet or whatever it is called now. There's the big citadel and the Turkish, whatever the Turkish town is now, it's called something different. And the main road. And right across from that, across the main road, is a valley, and it's still steep, but burned. And there's a city that was burned. And that's the place that everybody met. That's where they were.
They need to turn them on.
Did you hear what she was saying?
Yeah.
About the family.
Yes.
And how they escaped.
Yes. Well, what events triggered the exodus of your family?
1915, the massacres. My father was well established. I'll start with my mother. My mother lived in an area of Erzurum, that's a health area, Erzurum. Anyway, my mother would not tell me the whole story. And when I left Tehran, I was born in Tehran, I said, when you get back, I'll tell you, etc. Very simply, she told me that they asked the father to come out to meet the mayor, and he never came back. They took the mother next, and then he took all the elder children, and they killed them all, obviously. And then they were just left there, and that is where the story stopped. I'm trying to discover what happened to them. Did they end up in a orphanage? I'll kind of continue with that kind of thought. Was a Turkish family or a Kurdish family took care of the? My mother was about 8, and Gerhan, the brother, was about 4 years old. So the story, I have no idea, and I'm searching. But I said, well, how did he end up in Beirut? He said, well, my great-grandfather, her grandfather, came from Paris, found them in 1922. Found them where? I still don't know. Didn't ask at the time. And brought us to Beirut. And I said, what happened to your grandfather? Why Beirut? He said, well, he went back to Paris and slipped on a banana peel. I mean, this is such a funny story. And died. And that was the end of the story. But very simply, my mother and his brother ended up in Beirut. They ended up going to AUB nursing school. And on my father's side, it was a very interesting story. My grandfather died of not malaria, but typhoid fever, 1912, just before everything was happening. He escaped the early massacres. Very well educated, as I said, went to Amherst, in this case, yeah, Amherst. Something very interesting happened. When massacre occurred, when they started deporting people out of Aintab, my aunt Veronica was teaching piano lessons to the gendarmes, the big gendarme's wife that took care of Aintab. And because of the piano lessons, they got a little note saying, don't touch this family. So they were able to live in Aintab. The French came, the British came first, and then the French came. But they lived there till 1919. And then the night before it was really going to, the Turks were going to basically take care of the Aintabtis, he sent a gendarme to tell them that, leave town, get everything together, so you'll be leaving the next night in the middle of the night. And what happened was they basically took off with ox carts all the way to the railroad and ended up through Tripoli to Beirut. So for that reason, when I was thinking of finding a wife, one was intelligence, beauty, and piano play. Piano is very important. I'm serious. Because I heard my Auntie Veronica play when I was in Beirut, when I was 10 years old, and I visited them. Oh, just enthralled the piano playing.
Barbara, will you please stand up?
Anyway, that was my wife. Did I answer the questions? It went a little too long.
I think you did. I think you did a good job. See me atop that.
No problem.
What was the question?
Well, you can start with what events triggered the exodus of your family. Were there any specific things in the community they were in that you were told stories about what happened?
I have never talked about it. Occasionally, there would be a discussion about religion. My mother was the granddaughter of a first father, first Protestant ministers, and he was an Orthodox, but was saved by a Protestant minister and put into orphanage. So whenever there was a religious discussion, my father would also get upset and say, where was God? We were praying for him in their story. So he was very, very bitter. And my mother always would shut him up and say, don't spoil the minds of the children. So we never talked about what took place or what happened, except in later years I found a book that was written and published in New York in 1923. The title of the book is called Salak. Salak means pain. This lady describes, and this lady was my father's kindergarten teacher. So she describes the path that they took. And my father has drawn this march path to where they came from. And that painting is at our St. Sahar church now. So from that book, this lady, the kindergarten teacher, had a baby on the road, and she called the baby Salak. And that book is what we know about our family, other than a few discussions when my father would say that her mother would put the gold coins on their lap, on the children's belly, so that the gendarmes would not take it from the women. That's about all I know.
That's an interesting way that you learned about family history.
Yes.
But it was pretty well validated by the kindergarten teacher.
Yes, and I am looking for a good translator, and I would pay good money for it if you could translate that book from Armenian to English.
Well, let's go back to Carolyn. So the question that we have here is, what led your family to initially settle in this new land? So you left, and where did you go, and why did you go there?
In the U.S.?
Well, is that the next jump? No.
So my grandfather ended up, he escaped, he was hiding in the land that they owned, which after the war, when the Allies divvied up the Ottoman Empire and drew the lines, that part of his property ended up in Syria, in northeast Syria, mm-hmm. in a part near a town called Ras El Ain. So that's where he ended up, and my grandmother, her mother disappeared along the way, and she was taken as a slave by an Arab family in the desert. And in Aleppo, there was a Danish missionary called Karen Jeppe. And this woman would send Arab men into the desert and would give each one a gold coin for every Armenian woman or girl that they would bring back. Because a lot of Arab Bedouins in the Syrian desert stole or took the Armenian girls to be their slaves, maids, wives, whatever. And my grandmother was one of them. So what ended up happening is this Arab man that Karen Jeffy sent out, found my grandmother, but he got greedy. He wanted more than one gold coin. He knew about my grandfather, so he went to him and said, I can find you an Armenian wife for two gold coins. And my grandfather ended up basically buying my grandmother, who was 20-some years younger than him, because at the time, she was like a teenager, and he was already 30 years old. He already was married and had three children who perished, and he never saw them again. So he got married, and a lot of Armenians end up in Baghdad in Iran. So that's where his family settled. They had their first child, which died because there was no food. And then in 1922, they moved back to Urfa. And again, a lot of the Armenians from that part, because that part at the time was under the French protection, moved back to their home. Unfortunately, the French decided to give that up to the Turks. So they picked up and left and ended up in the refugee camp, Armenian refugee camp in Aleppo, which is where my father and all his siblings were born, where Azad and his siblings were born. So that's where they were born. And my grandmother was a clever woman. She realized the only way to get out of poverty and out of the camp was her education. The French at the time, Syria and Aleppo, was under the French protection. That was between World War I and World War II. And they were big on trying to force people to become Catholic. So my grandmother went to the French and said, we're Catholic, and my children deserve a good Catholic education. So all her children end up going to French schools for free.
the boys went to the Friars School, and the girls went to the Franciscan nuns went to schools. So they all spoke French better than Armenian, wrote French, and were French educated, because my grandfather realized education is the way to get out. And then the older brothers, when World War II started, Sierra was under the French protection, and because they spoke so well French, they all got really good paying jobs in the central, which was switchboard, communication switchboard. And my dad said, he was the second youngest, he said his older brothers at Christmas brought home chocolates. He said, we felt so blessed, we had chocolate. And that's how they were able to save enough money because of their jobs and then get out of the refugee camp.
That's what's about, your family's experience in this transitional time.
Well, one thing I forgot to mention, my father was actually, Theodore, was conscripted into the Turkish army, so that gave some protection to the family. And he had some accounting background. And he actually stayed all the way till 1921 in Marash as a hospital orderly, trying to save. He was working with injured soldiers, Turkish, French, whatnot. In a book, there's a little chapter that says, somebody came to him and said, Theodore, what are you doing here? You should get going, you know, the Turks are coming. He was very lucky. He somehow, even after that, he went back to Aintab, not knowing that everybody had left, because he was looking, I didn't mention that there were two parts, Grandma and the two and Uncle Arthur, and Josephine left with a boxcar. Veronica and my father went to work in the Marash Hospital. There was an American Red Cross hospital. They worked there for till about 1922, and they didn't know where everybody was. So they went back to Aintab to look at the house where they lived, and they saw this Turk there. They said, what's going on here? He said, well, they gave me this house. That was a prize we got. He said, well, enjoy it. We left it worth it. Enjoy it. They left. We kind of knew what had happened. But basically, so my grandmother and Josephine, the youngest daughter, and Arthur Bouboulian, who was in Rochester, left in the boxcar, came to Beirut. They had nothing. They stayed in some camps for a while. My father came later on and eventually found them. And initially, the reason they went to Beirut was because there was a railroad that to Tripoli to Syria, built by the Germans to get the oil out of that part of the country. Anyway, my father and mother ended up in Beirut. They didn't know each other. Auntie Josephine, which is my father's sister, worked as a nurse at this AUB hospital, and my mother was there. So Auntie Josephine said, I've got a brother that, you know, is looking for a bride. So they set them up, which they did, typically, for Armenians. So they married in 1940. My grandmother was also very, very wise. Number one, she somehow transported a large organ all the way to Beirut, the original organ. We still don't know how they did it. That's because they're really into music. And when I went to Beirut, the organ was sitting in her room. But anyway, my father got married, and because he was trained as a minister, he decided to go to Tehran, Iran, and convert the Muslims to Christianity, bring Christianity to Muslims. At that time, it was very open. If you even thought about anything like that today. So he was in the church, etc., and ran it. And he taught at Al Borz College, because he spoke English. He spoke many languages, but he spoke English, and he earned some money for the family, because otherwise, you know, working as a minister doesn't give you much money.
Question about this transitory time. How did Armenia, where's the family, what's the struggle, what's going on?
That piano reminded me of that movie.
Yeah.
The piano, how they transported that piano all the way to Australia. my father lived in the orphanage until he volunteered for the French army. He thought that he would be a flyer, so he volunteered and said the closest he came to an airplane was swimming. But after orphanage, I don't know how they got together, but through some connection, another Vestrovian married my mother, and they went to the town of Erhan in Iskander. And there, he worked for a fellow that was the military leader of the anti-resistance force. His name was Otto Levonian. Levonian tried to make butter from cream, and my father and him would read books about how to make it. And so they started making butter. And of course, my brother, sister, and middle brother were born in Erhan. Of course, in 1930s, 37 or something like that, the region of Iskander was given back. The French gave it back to the Turks. So they had to migrate one more time with their shirts on their back to Aleppo and to a refugee camp, and that's where I was born, in the refugee camp, until I was in the fourth grade. He was able to buy an apartment, and we moved to Sulaymaniyah, as I remember, big memories of the place.
What was the question? That's the Christian part of town. Sort of middle class Christians lived in
Sulaymaniyah. Sulaymaniyah. It was mostly Armenians, but then gradually the Arabs started moving in. And from there, one by one, we start migrating to America.
This is a general question, and I don't think everybody will know the answer, but where are you religious minorities in the secondary lands that you went to?
Yes, of course, Syria was 95% Muslim, and maybe 3% were Catholic Arabs. At the time I left Aleppo, there was about 100,000 Armenians there. So it was a big center for the Armenians, Aleppo, as well as Beirut. Not Damascus was not much, but Aleppo was the biggest Armenian population. And I think now it's probably less than 20,000 left after the Civil War.
When was America considered possible home?
I ended up here by chance. I came to visit a friend who was my best friend in the Armenian school. Her family immigrated to Los Angeles, so I came to visit her. And I just happened to connect with this American lady who knew my mother back from the 50s in Beirut. And my mother kind of stayed in touch with her through Christmas cards, basically. So she knew her address, so I contacted her. And she was 73 at the time, and I was supposed to go back. I was coming for a visit just 1 month, supposed to go back. This lady's only daughter was dying of cancer at the time, and she wanted me to stay with her, to keep her company at this difficult time, and offered to send me to the local community college for 1 year. So I took that opportunity, and I did so well in school that I applied to transfer to UC Berkeley, and I got a scholarship at Berkeley, and I went there, and then I was told I should go to grad school, so I got a PhD from Stanford, and here I am. So it was all by chance. It was never planned.
What's top that for?
Actually, one would say it was God's plan.
As I said, my parents said that we'd gone to Iran. I went to Persian schools, six, seven different schools. Went to Tabriz, to Isfahan, to Tehran. Eventually, when we came to Tehran, and my father settled down in Tehran, where we were originally, there was an American, it was called community school, American community school. And father said that would be a good school for you to go because I wanted to eventually go to. He didn't say that to me, but I think he was thinking of going to America. So I went to that school, and it was a good preparation to come to the U.S. I still keep in touch with all those people. You know, it was a small school. Russians that had escaped to Iran, people who were in higher Iranian politics sent their kids to that school. So it was a real international place. I graduated in 1960, and my father had a very good army friend that they communicated on religious matters. And this guy said, you know, there's a good school in Hannibal, Missouri. It's a good Lutheran thing. I think I can write to them. I was graduated from there. We went to Hannibal LaGrange College. And no choice. I went there, free scholarship. I worked in the kitchen to earn some money. And my father would send $10, $20. Which is... The important thing was that I was interested in building. And I thought civil engineers were builders. So I took all the civil engineering courses at this two-year college in Hannibal, Missouri, where Mark Twain was born. Real nice campus, whatnot. My uncle, by the way, lived in Rochester, Minnesota. That's not what got me here. But it was just this army sergeant recommending to my father that there was a good school in Hannibal, Missouri. To make the story short, I was going to work one summer between summer recess, went to my uncle's house, and there was a job with Green Giant. And just as I arrived, they closed the lines, you know, to accept any more people. So I spent the whole summer at my uncle's house, and I looked around. I'm exaggerating this, but I did look around. I said, what civil engineer built this house? He said he wasn't a civil engineer. It was an architect, and his name was Frank Lloyd Wright. I said, no. So what's an architect? He said, well, I got all the time to read these books on Frank Lloyd Wright. And I think I forgot to mention that my uncle's daughter is here.
Granddaughter.
Yeah, granddaughter. Anyway, and he had connections. He worked at the Mayo Clinic. He had connections, and he was also teaching at the university. He said, Ralph Rapson is one of the top architects that teaches there. I said, well, I want to go there. So I got my degree, went there, showed them my drawings and my portfolio of work and my background. They took me in immediately. It was, I worked very hard in that school. And it seems like everything I did something, every time I did something in class, they said, wow, this is good stuff, you know, very good. So I just kind of went up through the ranks. One of my professors hired me after I got my undergraduate degree. I was accepted to Harvard and MIT. I picked MIT because I think I want to, you know, do mass production, you know, housing, etc. And it was a very good experience. And so I ended up graduating. Got some really good offers. Am I going too far? Very good offers from big architects in New York. Took my wife to New York. She hated New York. We lived in a very nice apartment. I think they're pinching her. So we ended up back in Minnesota again. I had some good offers, and it was a very good decision. I'm very glad I came back to Minnesota.
Azad.
What's the question?
You know, I'm distracting you.
One of the things that goes, first is...
What about America? When did America become an
element? Okay. Well, I had to chaperone my sister to movies. And really, I had to go see Western before she took me to one of those love stories that Rob Hudson has had. So I fell in love with America. And of course, my father, not being educated at all, he had made a promise that all his children would go to Aleppo College. And you don't know what Aleppo College is, but you know what Harvard is. That's equivalent to paying Harvard tuition with no money. That was one of the, she's a graduate there too, I think. One of the premier high schools in Aleppo is established by American missionaries. So my brother worked for Iraqi Petroleum Company, and if you remember the Suez Canal War in 1956, they bombed those pumping stations, and he was furloughed for a long time. So when he got his back pain, he decided to leave the country. He felt there was no future there. So he came to Chicago to go to engineering school. So he was the first to leave the country. I always had dreams of coming to America. Must have been those convertible tops, dancing girls, or whatever it was. I was just fascinated with America. And more than that, we were considered a second class as Armenians that could not speak Arabic well, either went to the Greece mechanic shops and became car repair people, or there was no place for educated Armenians to find a good job. And so education was very, very important to us from the get. By the way, I didn't have money to even pay for my airplane ticket. And my father was a collector of Ottoman stamps. Of all the stamps, why would he collect Turkish stamps? I do not know. But he collected these stamps. And one day I went to him, I said, I want to go to America. I said, how are you going to go there? And I said, well, give me my inheritance first. So he sold that. It was a very beautiful collection of the first Ottoman stamps all the way through to a Franciscan priest. And that paid for my airplane ticket. And I had $30 my father rounded up and gave it to me, and that's where I landed in Boston. $30 in my pocket. My brother was already in the States, so he helped me to go to South Dakota State University. From then on, it's been just nothing but America.
Did you ever get a convertible?
I drove one of my roommates' convertibles.
I think we should give a big round of applause for these people. Get here, you really kind of answered that. Why am I here? A lot of it was luck, wasn't it? A lot of it was perseverance and family and reconnecting and so forth. Just amazing stories.
I want to twist this around. There is a very nice book, a fellow that came through here, I think, at the Francis Chambers, and compiled a book. This book is about Armenian immigrants to America and what they accomplished. I bought this book, so I was going to send it to Trump so he understands what immigrants do. Anyway, you must have been a little chauvinist. You didn't put your name down and put the patents there. But somehow you must not have been in Minnesota. But he lists 312 Armenian American scientists. 478 patents. 20 more should have been, because she has a couple of dozen at least patents. One of the patents was the MRI machine that was invented. The others were all to do with cars, of course. One is the automatic transmission. It is said that the Armenians live with the trauma, and the Turks live with the paranoia. It was, I think, Hrant Dink that said that. But I think he's wrong. We don't live with the trauma. We teach our children to be a shining star, but we remember.
I would like, if you have some questions, we'll try to keep it brief. Perhaps you have a question or two of three. If not, we can go to the lightning round. Oh, question.
I just have a question because I don't have a sense of, you're an engineer and you're an architect. You don't have a sense, Azad, of what you studied and what came after you went to South Dakota State University.
Well, I became an electrical engineer. Mm. At the time, it was Vietnam War, and everybody was going for electronics. But to get into those firms, you have to be a U.S. citizen. You could not get in through. So the only place you could get in is a power company like NSB. They did not care whether you were a citizen. I went into power, and and I got into a company in Minneapolis called Electric Machinery. Mm-hmm. And figured out that electrical engineering is fine, but I better learn the language of mechanical engineers. Because I didn't understand what they were talking about half the time. So then I went to the University of Minnesota at night to get a ME degree. And then they said, well, if you really want to climb up the ladder, you should get an MBA. So then I went to St. Thomas to get an MBA, and then moved to Mankato and never used So I got involved with power generation, basically power generation across drilling rigs or remote places, not the big power, more alternative power.
Any other questions? Yes, Peter.
Yes, food is so important to Armenians. Was there any food from the villages that, you know, that you grew up with and that you brought to America, or what do you remember your mom's cooking? That's from the Armenian villages.
Dolma.
Dolma.
Dolma and kufta. Kufta with which she makes. My mother made us forced us to eat those because if we discovered an almond or a walnut, then we'd be kind of deserving. But kufta and dolma were the two, baklajan or the eggplant. I don't know where my mother earned it because she had to grow up in a family.
I only remember two foods that my mother cooked. One was on Good Friday. It was awful tasting. There was no meat in it.
Where's the meat?
Where's the meat? There's no olive oil in it. It just tasted terrible. I think that was a way to make us fast. April 24th was another day that she didn't dig. She just cuts down. There was no supper. So those are the 2 days that I remember what she ate.
My mother wasn't really into Armenian cooking because her family came from Iskenderun, so they were, and her mother was Greek, so they had not much Armenian. But my dad, I remember cooking two things. One, he did that on Sunday lunch, which was the Armenian kebab with the eggplant. It's like ground meat alternated with eggplant slices. He would grill it on the menhav, this little, like a hibashi thing. So that was the Armenian thing that he made every Sunday. And then the other one, which he made only when somebody got sick, well, he called it the kelepacha, which I guess the Armenian word for it is khash. Oh, you take the head and the feet of the lamb and I smell awful. And the name kelepacha is Turkish. Kele means head in Turkish, pacha means hoofs.
The time was good and the brain.
So that's what I remember. Basically, those were my dad's
recipes. Brad, you mentioned on and off that you sometimes as a child know with your father and you out mission up.
Yes.
I would just love to hear more of that. I don't think it's
very interesting. My father, my father used to go to these villages to give out tracts, little tracts about Jesus Christ and save souls or how we do it. Anyway, I'd sit in the back.
I'd sit in the back of the donkey, and we'd go from one village to the other. Sometimes it pushes out of the village, kind of embarrassing. But we would give them tracts, but we didn't give it free. We'd get eggs for it. And so it was quite an experience of seeing all these villages and people, and sometimes wondering if they're going to kind of stone us out of the village. But that was his way of kind of ministering to the small villages. And we sent in the summers. We spent a whole summer in the village. It was a great experience living in these courtyard houses, renting a little room, watching girls and the mother make rugs all day long, you know, getting fresh milk, seeing the in the evening all the sheep coming in through there. And the sheep knew exactly where to go, in which houses to go. Anyway, yeah, that was a nice experience with the donkey.
Any other questions?
One of the three people, you don't know the answer, but would be, I know, for example, how Armenians learn about genocide in Armenia. I've read most of the Russian stuff on that. But I was wondering, in any of your countries, where did you, did you, in your education when you were young, did the events of 1915, were they at all treated, how did you learn about them besides family stories, in terms of academically or pop, in that sense?
For me, I'll be very, it was zero, nothing. Mm-hmm. I didn't read anything. My father didn't have books on the genocide, but they didn't print anything. But my father told us stories, and my mother gave us that brief view of what happened. So my father, didn't elaborate.
The Armenian schools. So my in Aleppo, there were a number of Armenian schools. I went to the AGBU school, and that was a big thing. We even had half the day off that day. And the whole neighborhood I lived in were mostly Armenians, and they were black marches. Very well taught and remembered.
Can I ask you, did the Syrian government, because the Soviet government always sort of used the genocide as a geopolitical thing, right? They're going to hammer the Turks, or they're going to hammer, so the Soviets used it in a particular way. Did the Syrian government do that also in a way?
No, the Syrian government stayed completely out of the business of the Armenians. I don't know how they did it, because I know when I was a kid, the Syrian government took over all the private schools. Like, the French lost their schools, the Americans lost their schools. Except the Armenians. They kept their schools, they taught their curriculum, they used their languages. I don't know how they managed, but the Syrian government was completely out of our business.
For the first 50 years, there will not be any or memorials on that genocide. It started 50 years later that people started publishing, writing, marching. But the first 50 years, as I remember in my childhood, we would go to either church or the Armenian club gatherings, and there would be a speaker that would talk about the events. So we did not have these scholars that trying to find what did Taner Artem call it, the smoking gun. We didn't need it. We knew it. We knew the truth right from the beginning. So there was no need for us to really search and hunt and read about it. We just lived it. We live in a refugee camp with 30,000 people, and it was not because we chose to get there, but events took us there. So to me, it has no value of promoting the politicians to recognize the genocide. To us, it is a fact. We don't need any proof. We don't need any documentation. We don't need any brainwashing about it. So that's why I say we don't live with the trauma. Let the Turks live with the paranoia.
Well, thank you very much. We're going to conclude with the formal part of the presentation. We're going to have some music. Nayuri, would you like to come up here and just explain what is transpiring?
First of all, thank you very much to the three presenters. And Francis did a wonderful job, and so did Tom with his as a moderator. And his bright ideas. So thank you to those four. But don't go away because we've got all kinds of things happening. First of all, we have two fantastic musicians who have agreed to come and entertain us. It's not going to be long, so you can still go wherever you want to go. We're going to start with Max Sundgren, who's going to be playing the cello, a piece, and then followed by Robert Bell, who will be playing the guitar, I believe, another piece. While you are mingling. Thank you.
Thank you. drive a Mustang, you know, a history, you know, like, this was on the phone.
Oh, yeah, see you on Friday.
Week from Friday.
Oh, yeah, week from Friday. Week from
Friday. Yeah, yeah, the last week was really good.
Don't say my French crash.
Thank you.